When President Trump said last week that the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan because of terrorists and the Soviets were right to be there, many historians gasped. The 1979 invasion by the Soviets is seen as a textbook illustration of unprovoked aggression. The U.S. backed the Mujahideen who fought and humiliated the Soviets, driving them out. So Trump backed the Soviet invasion, but in the past, Donald Trump has been critical of the U.S.-led invasions in Afghanistan and Iraq, criticizing President George W. Bush for launching the Iraq War and President Obama for withdrawing troops too quickly. At the time, Obama couldn't win a pledge from the Iraqi government that U.S. troops would be protected from prosecution, making the point it's hard to end a war once started, as President Trump may be seeing. After his call for a partial withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan and a full withdrawal from Syria, Defense Secretary Mattis stepped down. This past weekend, National Security Advisor John Bolton said withdrawal from Syria is conditioned on a pledge from Turkey not to target Kurdish allies there. As the debate over leaving these three combat zones continues, we thought we could use a brief primer on how the U.S. got into them in the first place. Some soldiers in combat now were barely walking when the war started. Stacy Goddard is professor of political science at Wellesley and incoming director of the Madeleine Corbell Albright Institute there. She's here now. Professor, welcome.
Thank you so much.
And let's start with Afghanistan, an invasion just 2 months after the attack on 9/11 by al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden's followers. The fundamentalist Taliban had been ruling Afghanistan at that point and was accused by the U.S. of harboring bin Laden. You know, there were a few voices raised at the time, a very few, saying, well, wait a second, instead of a full invasion, why not make this a criminal issue? You're nodding yes. In other words, hunt him like a criminal, which is ultimately what happened. Don't start a war. But what was the force that led the U.S. to the invasion?
I mean, I think it's worth noting that there were very few voices that were actually against an invasion. Part of that was the scale of the attacks. And it's also worth remembering that this wasn't the first time that the international community had thought about actually taking action not only against al-Qaeda, but against the Taliban, right? The Taliban and al-Qaeda had been linked in the late 1990s, both of them as terrorist organizations. And not only that, there was this opportunity about a month before the invasion of Afghanistan where the Bush administration had been asking the Taliban to hand over bin Laden, and they refused to do so.
And part of the concerns about the Taliban, ferociously fundamentalist, women were suddenly appearing in burqas. There was this voice being raised before even the 9/11 attacks about we should be paying attention to what's happening to women in Afghanistan.
Precisely.
But yet, I mean, when we think of those few voices raised, because they ring in my ears as this goes on to be the longest war in U.S. history, there were some people saying, look what happened to Russia. Describe the uniqueness of Afghanistan and why that has made war there so difficult.
Afghanistan might be one of the most complex political landscapes in international politics. When the international community gets involved attempting to reconstruct Afghanistan after 2001 and the fall of the Taliban, they didn't bring the Taliban to the table. They figured the Taliban was deposed. The problem there, though, is not only did the Taliban have a lot of support within Afghanistan, the Taliban also continued to have support with factions in Pakistan as well, right? It becomes a really complex geopolitical landscape as well with the involvement of Pakistan and other states as well.
And when President Obama came into office and decided to do a drawdown of U.S. troops, what was revealed was a vacuum into which went even more extremist groups like ISIS. And so troops had to go back.
Exactly. I mean, so not only was there the resurgence of the Taliban, but ISIS came in. And so this is actually now tying in the Central Asian region, the entirety of the Central Asian region as well.
The other through line, of course, is Iraq. We jump from 2001 to 2003. This is a war based on either faulty intelligence from the Bush administration or the Bush administration's outright lies about Saddam Hussein having weapons of mass destruction, having a relationship with Osama bin Laden. And there again, at the time, we did hear voices. They were faint. But pointing out that Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein hated each other. Saddam Hussein was secular. Osama bin Laden, fervently religious. Talk a little bit about the ideology at the time that was driving that invasion.
Right. The neoconservatives had really put their sights on Iraq since the end of the Gulf War in 1991. President George H.W. Bush made the decision to basically keep the United States and the coalition involvement limited.
Saddam Hussein had attacked Kuwait. They just decided to kick him out of Kuwait.
Exactly. And what they decided to do was basically contain him, mm-hmm. right? Keep him from being able to develop weapons of mass destruction, keep him from being able to actually invade any other countries, right? But that was it. Neoconservatives, if I'm going to boil their ideology down to two facets, it's basically that the United States has a moral responsibility to spread democracy. And the second of which is that the United States can spread democracy through the use of force.
Right.
So what they saw was not only a missed opportunity, but in many ways a moral failing on the part of the United States. They had this opportunity. They were right at Saddam's doorstep, and they did not go in, nor did they support the Shia uprising that happens right after the end of the Gulf War. So the 90s basically see the neoconservatives, Bill Kristol, Robert Kagan among them, calling for the United States to act as a global hegemon, to be willing to use force to go in and depose Saddam Hussein. So 9/11 presents an opportunity. And I don't even necessarily mean that cynically. For example, I think there's evidence that neocons like Paul Wolfowitz actually did believe, as strange as it might sound, that there was a link between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden mm-hmm. and the 9/11 attacks. Even if certain neoconservatives didn't see a link, they saw what happened on 9/11 as systematic, that if you allow these type of demagogues to maintain power, these were the types of movements that were going to be able to express themselves. In turn, if you decided to spread democracy, what you would end up is having all of these terrorist groups sidelined, because eventually people would be able to express their voice within the Middle East.
Right. The U.S. thought that people would rejoice when Saddam Hussein fell, but his iron fist was kind of what kept these different factions in the region under control. Talk about kind of the whack-a-mole aspect that the U.S. discovered.
You mean in terms of you might actually be able to eliminate one group, right? But
right.
The other one ends up popping up. This happens in Afghanistan and it happens in Iraq. The United States managing to fulfill some, if not many, of its military objectives on the one hand, but completely unable to fulfill its political objectives on the other. So obviously in Iraq, it's a very quick drive to Baghdad. It's a very quick fall of Saddam Hussein. The United States actually manages to basically eliminate al-Qaeda in Iraq. It ends up being able to mobilize the Sunni forces in the Sunni Awakening to kind of push al-Qaeda in Iraq out of Iraq, right? But every single time the United States does this, it shows itself unable to fulfill its political objectives, right?
Which
it
is.
Can't build a state, right? What ends up happening is eventually these forces, they emerge in another form. So the United States manages with coalition partners to defeat al-Qaeda in Iraq. But what it can't do is get Prime Minister Maliki in Iraq to stop suppressing the Sunni population. And what that means is eventually that Sunni population ends up flocking to the remnants of al-Qaeda in Iraq. And that's the group that becomes ISIS.
Okay. Right. Then we come to Syria. This is a conflict that started with the Arab Spring uprising, the people rising up against the Assad regime. It quickly became a civil war. When did U.S. troops go to Syria?
United States troops are in Syria because of ISIS. The United States actually was reluctant to take any form of military action, certainly not inserting ground troops, but even beginning to do things like creating safe zones that would be patrolled by United States Air Force.
And President Obama was criticized for that.
Absolutely, he was criticized for that. He was criticized for not doing more in the midst of what was clearly a growing humanitarian crisis. But once ISIS became involved, and once it also became clear that ISIS operations in Iraq and in Syria were so intricately connected, the United States' focus has been primarily on providing air support for operations that are conducted primarily by its Kurdish allies, with the assistance of training and special operations forces.
And obviously, Russia and Iran are also involved. Turkey's also involved. Mm-hmm. The critics of President Obama at the time felt that the U.S. wasn't taking its proper place and ceding Syria to these other countries. Now you have President Trump wanting to cede it completely by pulling troops out. So how do you, as a political scientist, view this moment in time? Three areas of conflict and concern about the cost in both dollars, but also in U.S. lives. What is your thought on this moment in time?
So I think this, along with another number of other events, going all the way back, thinking about the 2008 financial crisis, to thinking about the instability right now with the United States and its allies, increasing competition with China, increasing tensions with Russia. In some ways, it's unbelievable to think in the midst of this, the United States has been at war for 17 years. Mm-hmm. And moreover, what's particularly unbelievable to me is it seems that it's been at war for 17 years without many people paying attention to the wars that are going on. I'm not necessarily going to say as a political scientist, but maybe as an optimist, I would hope that perhaps this is a moment that the United States could perhaps begin to think about its grand strategy and its foreign policy in ways that are less reactive. And by that, I mean, these wars have come at the cost. They've come at the cost of money. They've come at the cost of lives. I think they've also come at the cost of missed opportunities to build more robust relations with its really strong allies, missed opportunities to think about how it can actually be leaders in areas like climate change, missed opportunities to think about how it can construct a foreign policy which isn't entirely reacting to the fear of terrorist threats. While those threats exist, they are not as costly as some of the other challenges the United States is facing today.
That's Stacey Goddard, professor of political science at Wellesley, incoming director of the Madeleine Corbell Albright Institute. Professor Goddard, thank you.
Thank you so much.